administration when we were on our tours. First of all, we're going to have Jim Showalter and Jane Rankin. One of the questions I have that's a little confusing to me is that we were allowed $135 million last year. We did $51 million. And they said we'd be allowed $970 million this year. Now they say we're allowed $965 and like $80 million dropped through the cracks. And I would like to have them explain that to me. But I think you knew that was going to be a question. Okay, go ahead.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Jim Showalter, State Budget Director at the Department of Finance. With me is Jane Rankin, Executive Budget Officer and Capital Budget Coordinator from the Department of Finance. In communication, we have a couple of questions that you wanted us to walk through, and Jane will address those questions in just 1 second. If you would just allow me to do one brief commercial beforehand. And that is, as you well know, Peter Sausen has worked with this committee for many years as our assistant commissioner responsible for debt management and treasury operations. He has retired and is still with us on a contract basis, but knowing that was happening, we've done a search long and hard looking for somebody who could fill in and take on those responsibilities for the state going forward. We talked with former finance commissioners, public finance officials, here in the state, and one of the names that kept on coming up was Kathy Cardell. It is our good fortune that Kathy Cardell actually accepted the position, and she's here, and I'm certainly will be seen by the committee many times in the future. Kathy has a broad experience in public finance at a number of public finance firms here in the metro area, most recently with Ehlers. In response to the specific questions, Jane has a number of different slides that we can look at. This slideshow is for the admin presentation, which is following us. We're more low-tech, but I will turn it over to Jane then.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm Jane Rankin with the Department of Finance. I have been the Capital Budget Coordinator for Finance since the end of the 2005 session, so this is my second time through the whole process. Mr. Chair, if you don't mind, I would like to hold off on answering your question specifically about changes in our debt capacity numbers until I've walked through some of the slides in the handout, because I think it will be hopefully then more clear if I give the framework first before we go to that question. So, Mr. Chair and Senators, I will be working from primarily the white stapled set of handouts that you all have in your packets. And for members who've been on this committee before, I know this is going to seem a familiar presentation, but the Department of Finance has a debt management policy, and we've had It is an executive policy. It is not established in law, but it is a policy that we have used to guide our capital budgeting process and manage our issuing of debt. It has three goals. The first one is to maintain or regain if we are not at the highest level, but to try to keep us at the highest level of bond ratings, the AAA or the AAA, however. There are three different rating agencies, and they all use slightly different numbers. So the shorthand I think of is to call it our AAA rating. We try to maintain that. We also are trying to minimize our state borrowing costs. And then lastly, we are looking at providing a reasonable level of financing capacity within a prudent debt limit. The best known, I think, feature of our debt management policy is what folks have referred to as the 3% debt limit. And that was established back in 1985 as part of the governor's 1985 capital budget. And it has been adhered to ever since then. If you move to the next slide number 3, I have some data on a few of the other aspects of, there are actually 5 debt management guidelines at finance, and this slide has information about 3 of the 5. The first line is the 3% limit line that I was talking about. In this slide, the numbers for 2006 and 2007 is actual. The other numbers are forecast. It's based on the combination of our debt capacity forecast and our revenue forecast. And that's simply because these calculations, these guidelines, are things that we can really only calculate at the end of a biennium. So if it's an intervening period, we're looking at a projection. The second line on this slide refers to another one of our debt management guidelines, which is that no more than 2.5% of our debt, our authorized debt, should be no more than 2.5% of our state personal income. Then the other piece of this slide is on here just to make the point that the way we manage our debt for the state is a little different than personally. If I think about what I have debt on, the biggest one is the mortgage of my house, and I am making a level payment every month for my house. But the way that the state manages its debt is we have level payment of the principal, so that we're, in essence, front-loading our debt. We are paying it off more rapidly than consumers typically do for their debt. The result of that is that we're spending less of our state's money on the interest payments and more on the project, the capital investment that we are getting. So then, Mr. Chair and members, if you would turn to the next slide, slide 4. This is a table that the debt management group at Finance has just recently put together. It's just another way to show the experience over time. For biennium, it compares the amount that we pay for debt service to the general fund non-dedicated revenues. And this is relating exactly to the 3% guideline, because the amount that we pay for debt service is to be no more than 3% of the non-dedicated general fund revenues. A couple things that I would say about this is that, as you know, all our GO bonds are backed by a statewide property tax levy. Last time we levied property taxes for debt service was back in 1966. And the very next year, the legislature began making appropriations for debt service. For about 10 years, when we would just pay the debt service when it became due. And then beginning in 1979, we began to regularize that process as well. So now we're in a situation, and we have been since the early 80s, where we are doing projections of what our debt service costs are going to be, and we're transferring the money out of the general fund into basically like a holding account so that it's there ready to pay the debt service when we need to. That whole system that has developed over the years is really another aspect of our debt management policies in the state, and it's another thing that you can point to say that Minnesota has a prudent way of managing its debt. If you go then to the next slide, I want to talk a little bit about our debt capacity forecast, because in order for the Department of Finance to be confident that we are going to be staying within the 3% debt limit, we need to do projections of where we know the amount of debt service that we have to pay because of bonds that have already been issued, authorized and issued. We have to make sure that we have room to pay for bonds that you have authorized, but we have not yet issued. And then we also know from experience that, from experience and from our budgeting process, that every 2 years now we have a situation where we are everyone's attention is turning to the capital needs of the state, and we're deciding about future projects that are worthy of funding. So we need to make sure that there is enough room to do all of those things and to give folks a guideline so you know how much resources you have available to fund the projects that you're looking at. Some of the assumptions that we make when we're doing our debt capacity forecast is we are assuming that in the even-numbered year, when you're considering bonding bills, we assume the same amount for each even-numbered year. So when we say now from the November forecast that our debt capacity is $965 million, that's assuming that you would be passing a $965 million GO bonding bill every 2 years, this year, 2010, 2012. We are also likewise assuming that you would have reserved for an odd year, a smaller year, off year bonding bill size of $120 million every odd year. And those two numbers, using under our debt capacity model, we calculate that the state would be able to bond for that level of projects, and yet we would still be right at the 3% debt guideline.
But the way we do it, we're never going to hit 3%, are we? I mean, if we authorize what we think is 3%, we're never going to get there. There's some things that aren't going to be done. Things fall through the cracks. There are some things that get pushed several years beyond. We're never going to hit 3% if we set it at 3%.
Senator Langseth, I think the way that I would answer that, I would direct your attention to the green sheet that you also have in your packet. The side with the number one at the bottom of the page, it's the slide that says general fund appropriations for debt service not to exceed 3% of non-dedicated revenues. Senator, what I hear you saying is you're pointing out, I think, the difference between our debt capacity forecast and the assumptions that we make for capital budgeting. Because you're right, when we are budgeting for an expected size of a bonding bill, we are instead looking at past experience. We use a 10-year, sort of every other year rolling average kind of a measure to, at finance, it's basically to come up with a budgeting estimate of how much we expect the bonding bill that you all will be passing in just a few weeks, how large that would be, and what the impact of that will then be on the state's debt capacity. And so that's why on this green sheet, if you notice that most of the bars are solid and a couple of them at the end are shaded a lighter color gray, and that's just to differentiate where actual experience leaves off and our projected calculation takes over.
If I may add just to that, Mr. Chairman, you're absolutely right. If the authorized level doesn't all actually become projects, that would be a factor that would lead you just to sort of a little bit south of the 3% figure on a consistent basis. There are other figures and factors that might lead you north of the 3% figure as well. say, if bonding package ends up getting spent faster than is generally assumed in these debt service calculations, or if just non-dedicated general fund revenues come down from the current levels, the current projected levels, that would then serve to increase that ratio from whatever percent to 3% or beyond. So there's a number of different assumptions that are built into that calculation. The one that you're mentioning certainly would lead you have a bias towards going under 3%. There are others that still would have to play out.
Now, these last two bars are based upon the 965, right?
Mr. Chair and Senators, the last two bars are actually based more on our capital budgeting framework, which is using that 10-year rolling average of enacted budgets. So it is assuming a even year bill size of $645 million and then an odd year bill size of $120 million.
Mr. Chair, and those are the assumptions that are built into our November forecast.
Yeah, I understand what's built into the forecast, but I also, that if we went at that level, we would be way below 3% if you did the 600-something. And I guess I would like a better explanation of what happened to the money that fell through the cracks last year. And do you just... You do the rolling average and push that all forward, so we basically kind of lost that for this biennium?
No, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. The question about what happened to the $135 million, million of debt capacity that we all were talking about last session, that has more to do with the kind of bonding projects that you all passed in the special session. And to back up and give a little bit of context, in this year where we're setting the large capital budget, Department of Finance, we have a framework of projecting the cash flows that are needed. And we need to project the cash flows for a bonding in order to size our bond issuances. So I didn't say that very well. I apologize. Let me back up and try it again. When a bonding bill is passed and enacted, every single project in that bill has available to it the appropriation in the bill immediately. If a project is ready to go the day after the governor signed it, they can put the paperwork through and we'll set up the appropriation in the accounting system and send out the money. And that is different from the way that the debt management folks at finance figure out when we have to do a bond sale and what size our bond sale is going to be. In order for the debt management folks to decide how many bonds we need to sell at a given bond sale, they are using estimates of cash flows, and it's something that they've developed over the years. For example, this year, in a big bill year, they estimate that only 15% of the total amount of GO bonds in the bill is going to be used in the first year. And then it goes, I have to find my notes, just a minute, 35%?
Yeah.
Is it written down?
That's okay.
That's pretty low, isn't that
15%? No, I have it written down. Oh, here it is. Oh, I'm sorry. It's 15% the first year, 35% the next year, 35% the year after that, and then it tails off pretty quickly, 15%, 2%. Now, in a...
Mr. Rankin, on that point, when you say 15% the first year, is that the first fiscal year or to the calendar year?
Mr. Chair and Senator Frederickson, in the bonding arena, it's not tied so much to fiscal year as to the year that the bill is enacted. I mean, so we would talk about this bonding bill being the 2008 bonding bill.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Rankin, let me ask you a question a different way. The effective date of the bill, let's say, is July 1st. When you say 15% the first year, is that from July 1st to December 31st or from July 1st to June 30th?
Mr. Chair and Senator Fredrickson, that would be from July 1st through the following June 30th.
Okay, thank you.
Then, Mr. Chair and members, in an off year, in a small year, we have a different schedule of assumption about cash flows, and it's partly because the assumption that we make at finance is in an emergency year, you want the money to go out faster, that the projects need the money quicker. So we have a different schedule of cash flow assumptions. What I've learned about the special session from last September is that because of the strong interest in getting the money out the door immediately, we actually used cash flow assumptions that are twice as fast as we otherwise would have. So we were assuming that those bonds will all be sold by November of this year, 2008. And otherwise, we would normally have put them in our model, assuming that they would not be all sold until June of 2010. Because of that change in the way that we made the assumption about the cash flow, then those bonds essentially had the same effect as if there were $135 million in debt capacity going out under the more standard cash flow assumptions. So that's the reason.
From what I have heard, and this is probably a couple of months old now, the people down that area were saying they're just not getting the money. They received a very small part of that, what, $51 million in bonds. Now, has that changed in the last couple of months?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I actually looked at that just this morning, and no, you are correct. At least as far as the GO bond portion of that bill is concerned, less than $1 million looks like has been spent in our accounting system. Now, I have to say that the trunk highway bonds, it's a different matter. About 50%.
Well, we're not dealing with trunk highway bonds. But the thing is, here you tell us on one hand that these are going to be sold much quicker than normal, and now, many months later, you've sold less than $1 million out of $51 million.
Mr. Chair, I have to, you're correct, although there's a distinction that I'm trying to make between what we do at finance to decide when we're selling the bonds and how much we're selling, and the assumptions about cash flow that go into that, from when the money's available for the project. So if the folks down in that part of the state, if they were ready for the money, it would be there and available for them. I think that I don't recall exactly the provision in the bill, but I do know that when the bonding dollars are going out through a state agency, through a grant program, it does take time sometimes to get that mechanism set up. There can be quite a bit of time involved in just initial meetings and understanding what's going on and getting your grant agreements executed before money actually goes out the door.
Well, it seems to me you made the wrong assumption last fall, because here you're saying that they're going to go out faster than normal, and 6 months later you're telling us less than $1 million out of 51, and I just have an idea 6 months from now there'll still be a fairly small amount of that coming out. I think I could make better assumptions than the Department of Finance to tell you the truth about it, but. I guess I'm not the one that people go by.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think that's a good point that you're making, and I'm sure that we will learn from our experience, and that will inform our decisions in the future if we're faced with another situation like this.
I will make a prediction. If we stick to 965, these two gray bars here are going to be much lower than what you've got on here. And they're considerably below 3%.
Mr. Chair, they are below the 3%.
And they're going to be considerably more below the 3% by the time it happens.
Mr. Chairman, having put forth that information, what do you intend to do with it?
Well, I don't know. There may have been some agreements at the leadership level about 965. I'm not sure. But I have also been having a number of people tell me, you don't have to stick to the 965. So it isn't just up to me to decide. But I think I could go a fair amount above that and still stay below the 3%. And that would help a great deal. I tell you, you don't you have no idea what holding to that 965 entails. In 98, we had a $990 million bill. I'll bet you that would cost us over $1.5 billion today. And so what we can do just shrinks as these huge increases in building costs have been going up. And then besides that, I think we got something that I don't really agree with here.
Mr. Chairman, do you see any solution? The things you talked about, the money in an expedited process, and then it still isn't used for 6 months or whatever. Why? And what directions can you give to the Department of Finance?
Well, they're supposed to be giving direction to us, and I just think they're giving us the wrong direction. I had basically told them to explain to me what happened to this $80 million or whatever we didn't spend last year, and I guess that just kind of gets pushed forward and rolled into the next 10 years.
Mr. Chairman,
apparently this less than $1 million that you put out so far is far less than you anticipated last fall, right?
Mr. Chair, members, it's far less than I think than anybody assumed last fall.
Okay. Well, I could have made an assumption that would have been a lot closer, I think, but then I'm just a country boy with a high school education.
Oh, my.
Yeah, yeah. I and Coring were the uneducated ones here. Is that a stump?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to go back to the, see if I understand the sale of the bonds at, in the first fiscal year, it was 15%, and the second one was 35, and then it kind of tails down. Is the reason for the 15% in that first fiscal year that the projects aren't ready, or is it that the Department of Finance has capacity from previous authorization or some other mechanism that you can take care of it? Let's say if we passed the bonding bill this year and 75% of those projects were ready the minute the governor signed it, which say if it's $900 million or whatever, $600 million of them are ready to go, and 1 week past the governor's signature, what would happen? Where would you get the money if you only sold 15% of the bonds?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I think the simple answer is if, say, $600 million was ready to go and was ready to be spent the day after enactment, we'd have to go get some cash very quickly. The assumption that Jane talked about of 15%, which debt management is basically held true over the years, is based upon an average portfolio, essentially, of the bonding package. Some of them are ready to go right away. Some need some more architectural or design work. Some are ready to go once the building, the seasons are ready, or that some land acquisition is taken care of. All kinds of factors are involved in the whole bonding bill in across that spectrum. If that was to change significantly, then you would expect that spend rate to change significantly as well, also driving up the debt service costs for the state.
One explanation, I suppose, could be that bonding bills tend to be kind of a late bill. You know, that's kind of sometimes what pulls the session, you know, to a close once we get that solved. But my understanding is that the it's kind of like a rolling authorization. I mean, we give you authorization to sell $900 million, mm-hmm. and you sell, you divide it up over 3-4 sales of the year. Maybe it's more than that. And you just kind of lump all that authority together, and you just kind of, you know, keep selling. Is that a correct assumption or explanation? Or
Mr. Chair and Senator Stump, yes. We sell typically in a biennium. We have just 3 bond sales, and so we are managing sometimes the brand new authorization from a bill that's just been passed, but sometimes there might be authorization from a previous year that we have not sold yet. The thing to realize is that in the Department of Finance statute, the legislature has given us authority so that we can borrow from the general fund in anticipation of a bond sale. And so that's why I was saying that it doesn't slow any particular project down. When it is ready for funds that you have appropriated for it, the funds are there. It's trying to break the link between when a project has money available for it and when the Department of Finance goes to market and sells bonds for the state.
One final question, Mr. Chairman. If the financial point at making an excellent low interest sale occurs, would you double or triple those bond sales, knowing that, gosh, you know, in a 6 months they could be 1 point or 2 points higher or something? What would you do?
Mr. Chair, Senator, fortunately Kathy Cardell will have to make those calls in the future. knowledge that I have is basically we can't do arbitrage. We can't go and grab those funds at low interest costs and then invest them at a rate that would earn us money. So we would go out to market for whatever we think we need at that time.
Mr. Chairman, is there what prevents you from doing that?
Federal law. Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator, federal law.
Hi. I'm Kathy Cardell, Assistant Commissioner of Finance, and I can talk about some of your general questions, although not so fluently as Jim and Jane on the specifics of the bonding bill. Federal tax law prohibits governmental entities that issue tax-exempt bonds from arbitraging the proceeds of those bonds, fundamentally. So we used to be able to do that pre-1986. We haven't been able to do it for many years now.
Yeah, we could do it.
Well, you have a fund there. It's available, even now, right? Several million dollars?
Yes.
Okay, what is being done with those funds?
That's a statutory 19 months, right?
Mr. Chair, those funds are, they sit in our treasury and earn interest until we need to make our debt service payments. We are allowed to earn interest on funds that we are holding that will be used to make our debt service payments.
What is it that you aren't allowed to do then?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, The money that's sitting in that fund is, I believe, a constitutional requirement that there be 19 months of debt service. Fundamentally, you are earning at a short-term interest rate. You're allowed to earn under federal arbitrage regulations up to what is called the arbitrage yield on the bonds, which is calculated each time bonds are issued. But just the nature of the fact that those monies on hand in that fund are short-term, essentially investments, versus the long-term rates that you're paying on your bonds tends to be lower. There's no arbitrage opportunity there generally in a normal interest rate environment.
Okay. Senator Wergen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Even at a county level, that holds true. And if you bond and don't use the money as quickly as you thought, and it sits in a fund and you earn too much interest on the money that you took out to bond for, you end up paying substantial penalties and fines to the federal government.
Paul, how does Commissioner Wergen know that?
Any further questions? Senator Foley.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Can you kind of run us through a process that takes you from the start and the authorization by the legislature, and at what point do you determine that you're going to sell and or to buy and so forth?
It's going to take 20 minutes.
Do you understand what I'm trying to say?
I do, Mr. Chair and Senator Foley. I, full disclosure here, I have to say that I haven't been involved in the bond sale part.
This particular thing, just in general, tell us how you take it from.
You mean how the process goes? Or?
Yeah, and who determines when you're going to sell and when you're going to dispense it to the governmental unit,
Mr. Chair and Senator Foley, after a bonding bill is enacted, then I know that as a budget officer at Finance, we go through and we set up appropriations in the accounting system so that every project, every agency has an account for with the amount that was appropriated in the bonding bill. We also actually will go through at that time, read the law, and if there is a condition on an appropriation, such as a match that has to be met, we actually go in and inactivate that appropriation account so the money could not be accessed. But otherwise, the money is available in the appropriation then for the particular project. So I know that I used to work with MNSCU and with the U of M, and they know that when the bill is passed and they got money for a project, they just go out and start working on the project, and then as they have bills to pay for the project, they are accessing the money in our account for them in the state's accounting system. If it happens to be a building project and MNSCU is responsible for paying one-third of the debt service, then the debt management group is actually sending another office at MNSCU the bill saying, hey, you owe us, you know, whatever your one-third debt service share is for the particular project. But that, at a very mechanical level, that's how the projects are getting funded and the work gets done. Now, that's different than, well, at the same time that that's going on, the debt management group at Finance is looking at when is the right time to go to market, how many bonds do we need to sell to come up with the money that we need to pay for all these authorized projects, both the ones that have just been enacted and the ones from years past. That's why if you see one of the sheets in the handout that I gave you, it talks about if you go back and look even in the 2005 bill, there's still some bonds that were authorized that have not yet been issued. And that's all the debt management group at Finance is keeping track of that. They are then using this idea of the cash flow estimates to help size the amount of bonds that they want to take to market. And then they go through the whole process of going through a bond sale and selling the bonds.
Thank you. Senator Frederickson.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Rankin, I have a historic trivia question to ask you. When you're talking about historic debt service, you said we haven't issued, we haven't paid debt service from property tax since 1966. Before that, was debt service always paid with property tax?
Mr. Chair and Senator Frederickson, I confess I'd have to go back and look. I learned that little tidbit when I spent yesterday going through our old official statements from old bond sales, gleaning bits and pieces of information. So I did find a statement about 1966 was the last time we levied the property tax. But further back than that, I have to go back and try to dig it up. I don't know.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Rankin, when did the state start issuing bonds for capital projects? It's fairly, in the history of the state, it's fairly recently, isn't it, like the 50s?
Mr. Chair, Senator Frederickson, I don't know. I have to look that one up, too.
Chairman, there was a constitutional amendment, I think it was in 1962, that enacted the current system of authorization for general obligation bonds. Before that, there was no general authorization for the state to go into debt to build buildings, and so the state paid cash, or in some cases, they tried to create a special fund, a special tax that would be levied just for paying the debt service on this particular bond issue, sort of looking like a revenue bond kind of thing. But it was a special fund, and that was used for limited purposes.
Thank you.
But these bonds are still backed by property wealth of the state. So if we wanted to, we could just put it on the property tax, apparently. We haven't done it even when it's, you know, we've been in a big dive, so we're not going to do it. But I expect we get somewhat lower interest rates simply because the bonds are backed by all the real estate property of the state.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, actually, the very nature of the general obligation pledge that's attached to these bonds is what is the driving force in the interest rates that you pay, not whether or not you are actually levying property taxes or whether you're using other general fund revenue to pay it. The assumption that has been made when the bonds received the AAA ratings from Fitch and from Standard & Poor's and the AA1 rating from Moody's is that you will provide your full faith and credit and pay from any source available, including property taxes. But where you actually pay it from is irrelevant in terms of the interest rates that would be paid or that you would receive when you sell those bonds.
Mr. Chairman?
Peter?
Just some more historical trivia on this. The reason 66 was an important year, the last year that debt service was paid from the property tax, was because 67 was the important year where the legislature enacted the first sales tax over Governor Levander's veto. And the stated purpose of the sales tax was to reduce property taxes. They called it the property tax reduction bill or something. And the idea was to use that sales tax revenue then to pay the debt service on bonds. Sales tax into the general fund, use general fund money to pay the debt service on bonds.
Hey. Any further questions?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Sinjum.
Mr. Chair and two of the other witnesses, I'm probably going to expose some of my ignorance to all this, but you drive down or, you know, you just kind of walk down Main Street and talk about some of this stuff, and you come to learn pretty quickly that right now, from the standpoint of the way bids are coming in on projects from contractors and so on. It's, you know, the bids are good. They're very favorable. And then also, at least, you know, you go over to the county courthouse and you talk to the commissioners and you find out, well, geez, the interest rates on the bonds that they're buying are pretty low. And so it all seems to suggest that it's a good time to do stuff, you know, from the standpoint of government cost. And if that's true, then could you not think about nudging that 3% a little bit and not get hurt too bad? Or is it, of course, the 3% is based on the revenue projections coming into the state of Minnesota. If you have faith in the confidence of Minnesota in terms of its revenue, then you ought to be able to take advantage of these good times to build, it seems to. Does that make any sense? Probably not.
Well said.
That covered from you.
I'm glad.
But it is a good time to build.
I was thinking it. You said it. But it's so much more credible coming from you.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Big spender.
Well, as I understand, the bond ratings have more to do with the situation with our general fund and whether things are very, very sound as far as the ability to pay rather than the level of the debt. Isn't that correct?
Mr. Chair, members, I think there's a number of different factors. We usually talk with each of the rating agencies a couple of hours going through a number of different factors, including the state economy, the financial management construct, and how we're sort of managing with whatever is going on within the state, as well as the specifics of the budget and what's happening, what are the growth factors, where are our weaknesses, and where are our strengths. So all of those factors play together, along with our capital budget, capital investment policy, to give that information, provide that context, and then they rate us and contrast us with other states. So no one factor is, a make or break. It's the pattern of how we behave, how we manage our affairs is a very critical importance, and those things change over time. Certainly, our financial guidelines have been one of the things that we've talked about with the rating agencies throughout the years.
I expect if I went into a bank to borrow money, their main concern is that I have the ability to make the payments rather than how much I borrow.
Mr. Chair, that is certainly correct. And since Wall Street would tend to like more borrowing than less because they'll make fees off of that, there is sort of that they're not so concerned with that, but it is the ability to pay, the atmosphere in which we're managing it, our ability to have reserves and handle our overall economy, job growth, all of those factors, just many, many factors are involved in that discussion. Part of what Minnesota has historically been able to hang its hat on is our financial management. That's one of the factors. We're stronger than most other states. That's one of the reasons we've been able to keep the AAA is because due to bipartisan executive legislative cooperation, we've had those principles. We've had balanced budgets. We've been looking at the long-term budget. We've got a lot of practices institutionalized that other states haven't been able to manage.
Chairman.
Senator Coring.
Mr. Chairman, if you're going to get bonds, wouldn't it help, the bankers here, Senator Metzen, but wouldn't it help if you had, like, a good negotiator to go there and kind of negotiate on bonds? I got to tell you a little story about I have a commercial loan at the bank, and it was 7.99, and I went into the bank and acted a little naive, and I said, geez, I checked at the other bank, and they could give it to me for 6.25, and they says, oh, well, we can do it for prime. So they gave it to me for 6. And I, could we have a good negotiator and maybe get a cheaper rate on bonds, or doesn't that work that way?
I don't expect it works that way.
Oh, okay. Right, because I was offering my services.
Actually, these bonds go out for bids, right? And the lowest bidder gets it.
No. Oh, okay.
So you don't need a negotiator. We just got a system that works.
Okay. Yeah. Trying to help.
Mr. Chair, members, I think some members were present for a bid within the past year, and certainly if you'd be interested in doing that, it's a fascinating experience. Within about 15 seconds, you'll have a number of different bids coming in, and we take the lowest.
But let it be recorded that the Republican leader of the Republican Party wants us to go over 965.
Well, sure, I didn't say that. certainly didn't say that.
Oh, come now.
You said it's a good time
about
to build.
Let's play the tape back.
You know, no, the sun shines.
I tell you, we got it on tape. He can't. Yeah. He can't back up now.
I'm trying to, but.
Okay, thank you.
No.
No, your credibility's on the line. Don't flip flop on us.
That ball player.
Okay, Department of Administration bonding requests.
Cindy.
I believe it's Dina Badgero. I'll let both of you introduce yourselves so you get the name right. And this is the one department or agency that did not testify before us during the interim, so we'll go ahead.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Dana Badgero. I'm the Commissioner of Administration. We're here to present the governor's recommendations from our department. Two of them are repeat visitors to this committee. The first one is the refinishing of the MnDOT facade, which has been the number one budget request from the Department of Administration for the last 5 years. The second one is a project that we presented last year and was approved and included in the bill, which was the acquisition of 639 Jackson Street. Nikki Giancola, Assistant Commissioner, is here with me, and she's going to go through a very brief PowerPoint presentation. We have a few visual aids we'd like to show you with respect to a couple of the projects, but I'll introduce Nikki at this point.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, Nikki Giancola with the Department of Administration. Just a couple of comments prior to walking through our specific requests. Here's a slide of the Department of Administration's mission and goals. Just a reminder, the Department of Administration provides a variety of services to state agencies. In regard to facilities, though, we believe we have both a leadership as well as a stewardship role in ensuring the wise use, allocation, and maintenance of our existing buildings, in addition to supporting sustainable investments in new facilities. Our capital planning and budgeting process, our approach, in other words, for the 2008 capital cycle was to concentrate heavily on preservation of existing assets and on life safety issues, but we were also mindful of opportunities that would align with the state's strategic plan for locating state agencies and as well as the program needs of a variety of state agencies. We went through a process of evaluating previous capital budget proposals. There were extensive discussions that took place between the Plant Management Division and our Real Estate and Construction Services, which is a combination of both construction and leasing services. We took a look at the current facility condition audit for the state, and we held a number of discussions with other state agencies regarding their capital needs. We categorized those needs based on what I call the drivers behind them. There were a set, starting off with those that would be mandatory drivers, for instance, emergency needs, security, fire life safety, and our CAPR request. Next, we took a look at asset preservation as defined in 16B.307. We had a number of projects that were put forward having to do with efficiency, reliability, and the potential for revenue generation, and then finally took a look at requests for new construction. I wanted to comment, we made use of the vulnerability assessments that were done in 2006 by the National Guard. We took a look at the recommendations that came out for those, specifically on the Capitol complex. Each building had one. So we used the recommendations there. But this listing that you see before you represents our primary capital planning considerations. The next slide is simply a listing of the five projects that I'll walk you through today. The first two, as Commissioner Badgero mentioned, we're bringing these back from the 2007 session. The DOT project itself. This is the sixth time we've presented this particular project, and it is our absolute number one priority. The State Capitol Building, this is an asset preservation request for the Capitol. Our biennial request for CAPRA, which is the Capital Asset Replacement and Preservation Account, and then finally a pre-design request for an Emergency Operations Center. I'll start you off with the Department of Transportation building. For those of you maybe not familiar with this project, this is talking about the building that sits on John Ireland Boulevard for the Department of Transportation. It is our number one priority. The issue with the building is its exterior facade. The structural support system that holds the granite panels in place is in a state of deterioration. It is deteriorating year by year. The project itself would be to restore the integrity of the structural support system and reuse the granite panels that exist on the building today. The repairs on this building have been ordered by the City of St. Paul and the Department of Labor and Industry, and we, as far as insurance goes, the coverage is currently excluded on the granite panels themselves or any event relating to the granite panels. From a life safety perspective, this project is critical. It is way beyond just a maintenance issue. The repairs need to take place. The project itself involves removing the panels, abating the asbestos that's behind the panels, removing the structural support system that's there today. It's a steel structure system. It's reinstalling a stainless steel structure system, and then basically rehanging all of the panels. It's also providing for what we call a weep system to allow moisture to weep through the system rather than be held in place, and that really is the crux of the problem there. Water has been retained behind the panels, leading to this rusting process that's going on. I think let's go to the next slide because this is some of the visual of what's going on in the building. Commissioner Badgerow is also holding a number of spalled pieces off the building that consultants and engineers have gathered as they've been doing inspections. These are actual pieces of the granite panels that have come off the building. The top right photo that you see there, actually both of them are evidence of this spalling process. It's typical of the spalling that's going on all sides of the building. And the discoloration of the stone that you can see there is evidence further that that rusting process is taking place.
I might interrupt. We do have another visual aid here that more graphically explains what's happening with these granite panels, but I'm feeling like it's a deja vu all over again because I think we've explained this process to this committee a number of times. If any particular senator has an interest in seeing how this actually is occurring, as I said, we have a visual aid that shows it, but I'm thinking maybe it's not necessary with this committee, Senator. Mr.
At this point, the trunk highway bonds aren't going to be part of this bill anyway. They sometimes have been, sometimes not. Sometimes we put it in both, hoping that it passes one and it never ends up getting passed.
Okay.
From either.
The next slide is actually, it's probably some of the most dramatic visual of what's occurring there. On the bottom left, that photo is of one of the steel columns that's in the north stair tower of the DOT building. That has deteriorated to the point where you can just reach in and pull that rust off. Now that is one of, thankfully we've got redundancy in that tower, but this is evidence of what's occurring on those support columns.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Foley.
On that building, this problem has been around for quite a while, but is this an industry standard so that if this were the IDS building or some other building, would we be able to fix that so we don't have to come back in 10 years or 15 years or whatever it is?
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes, that is the point. The way the repairs would be made today, two things. We're going to be using stainless steel rather than just the raw steel. And one of the issues on this particular building, and it would be in any building that had the same conditions, the panels had caulking installed at some point in the past, which was retaining the moisture. I'm not an engineer, but I have to believe that if that system had been allowed to weep through, the moisture to weep through, I don't know that we would be seeing the level of deterioration that we are here. But I think the potential has always been there. And in any building that was built around that time using those conditions, I would venture to guess that you would be seeing the same.
Mr. Chair, We had the same problem in the courthouse out in Anoka. It was a kind of a situation where the water came down and it rusted the concrete comes in and you get a steel thing in. And that kind of, but they haven't used that stuff for years. So is this going to require a total building change? And what's the end result after you fix it?
Mr. Chair and Senator, it is going to involve the entire building. There were some repairs made to the south facade of the building in the early 2000 timeframe. I think it was 2001. The building itself was built over the years 1956 to 1958, so that's the kind of construction that we're talking about. Yeah. But the repair should be the lasting repair.
And Mr. Chair and members, I just want to emphasize that we are, of course, eager to make sure this is included in any and all bills with the prospect that this year, at long last, we can have this approved. I do want to emphasize that we are under a code citation on that building by the City of St. Paul and the Department of Labor and Industry as a potentially unsafe building. We are there conditionally right now upon the basis that we are going forward again with a request to fix it permanently. But we do not have continued assurance that we will have a certificate of occupancy for that building if, for whatever reason, we're unable to make the repairs this year. We did invest $700,000 in making the intermediate repairs last summer, which involve reinforced walkways and sensors, which I guess Ms. Giancola can explain. But the we appreciate that it is not potentially in this committee's bill, but we know that we want the attention and interest of each and every senator because of the critical importance of doing this year.
I fully expect the transportation bill will be signed by the governor and considering this urgency.
Okay, Mr. Chair, the next project is a property acquisition request. Funds in the amount of $2.325 million are being requested to purchase some available property that's located on the Capitol Complex. It's at 639 Jackson Street. It is currently the home of the Central Park United Methodist Church. Here's a graphic showing the location. You can kind of see that it's sandwiched between the Stassen Building and the 14th Street ramp. In the 2006 timeframe, the church itself approached us and stated their intent to sell. The state of Minnesota has first right of refusal on three of the parcels that make up that piece of property. And we brought it forward as a recommendation in the 2007 timeframe. There is approximately $855,000 remaining in a previous property acquisition account that we have, and that, along with the $2.325 million, would give us what we need to purchase that property. Short term, the intent here would be to raise the building. The building itself is in pretty poor shape. It is still being used for a number of programs by the church, as well as the Regents Hospital is leasing a portion of the building. This presents I call it a moment in time type of opportunity to purchase this property. Land on the Capitol Complex is scarce, as most of you know. Back to my point, the short-term use of the property would be to raise the building and use it for surface parking. There are a number of agencies on the east end of campus that have a fairly significant amount of visitor traffic. One of the most significant agencies is the Office of Administrative Hearings that moved to the Capitol Complex late last year. Obviously, they have a lot of in-and-out traffic. They would have a use for visitor parking. We would transform our existing parking lot and this piece of property. We would rework it into as many surface parking stalls as we could get. There's also the Departments of Agriculture and Health down in that area and revenue. Long term, the thought would be to use it for future state development.
This was included in the bill last year, and we were able to persuade the owner of the property to extend the option through July 1st of this year to get us through another legislative session.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just say that
I know that a lot, there's been, over the last 6 years since I've been here, a lot of my constituents who have traveled 150 miles down here, and there's really no place to park. You know, and we want open government. We want people to come down here and tell us how they feel. And then when they get down here, there's no place for them to park. I don't think that's a good thing. Unless, well, yeah, well, then they don't always know that, Leo. So anyway, that's just my two cents.
Our next request is an asset preservation request for the State Capitol building in the amount of $15.4 million. $13.4 million would be used for critical maintenance or the most pressing needs of the Capitol currently, and $2 million for continued planning toward the full restoration of the facility. The $13.4 million would address, as I said, the most pressing and critical needs of the building. It would include site work to stabilize and address deterioration of the plaza and terrace areas. It would be to replace the crumbling tile that exists at several of the balconies on the building and repair of the east and west side stairs. It would also include building exterior projects to repair leaking roof areas, dome tuck pointing, and replacement of the dome windows. It would include mechanical and electrical infrastructure renewal, as we call it, and replacement of air handling units that are at most risk of failure. And finally, it would include some building interior work on emergency lighting, replacement of selected rain leaders, and pressure testing of some of the plumbing piping, as well as Rathskeller and Rotunda air quality, investigating those issues in that area. I will point to a visual that we do have of the Capitol. Below and to the right of me here is a approximately 4.5-foot piece of rain leader that our plant management folks were able to get out of the old judicial dining area in the lower level of the building. Many of you on tour maybe saw that area. But this is a cracked rain leader. And again, fortunately, we were able to pull it out so that people could see it. But there are some 20 rain leaders running through the walls of the building. This is a cracked one. This is original, over 100 years old. If they're all in that condition, and we have no reason to believe that they aren't in some state like this, that is representative of the risk that we're living with in the Capitol. So what we would intend to do with this asset preservation request is do a lot of investigatory work on those rain leaders, and where we could, without too much disruption, go in and pull out, see what the condition is, and replace them. The rain leaders themselves are simply directing the rainwater from the roof levels down through the interior of the building and out. So, I guess that's what I have on the Capitol. Again, it's to address the most pressing needs.
Mr. Chair and members, if I might, on the State Capitol, you may recall that we were here testifying last session about a proposal that our designers, our architects, had put together. I think the architect was even here and made a presentation of a three-phased program that would fully renovate the Capitol, provide new visitor spaces, address all of the handicapped accessibility problems, security, life safety, failing mechanicals, waterproofing. It was a total top-to-bottom renovation plan with a price tag of $260 million. And there were mixed reactions to that plan. The result was that there was a committee formed under the auspices of the LCC where both Senate and House, as well as other occupants of the building, including the Attorney General, the Governor's Office, the Supreme Court, the handicapped community, and others, met over four sessions to try to come to some consensus around what the renovation of the State Capitol ought to look like. And regrettably, the bottom line is that group was unable to come to consensus, so we do not have a bipartisan full House and Senate and other occupant agreement with respect to what the full renovation ought to look like. Failing that agreement, the governor is here proposing that we must at least, at a bare minimum, address the things that we know are most broken and most in need of repair. But this is truly an emergency request that we're proposing here today, with an additional $2 million to enable us to keep going with the dialogue and to look at alternative designs.
I will say that you have a brochure in your packet. That brochure is not the governor's recommendation, obviously. It is, however, the last set of recommendations that we in the Department of Administration and the CAP Board, working with our architect, put before this LCC committee as an option. The price tag for the first phase under the other plan was $130 million, which everybody felt was really too steep given all of the other competing demands, and we were asked to put together a plan that had a smaller initial down payment, if you will. And that's what this represents, $63.9 million in the first phase. It stretches the program out over 8 years instead of six. Unfortunately, the bottom line is that you get a little bit less with that plan for a price tag that is $307 million. So, you know, that's the price tag or the penalty we pay by not moving forward with a plan. Every single year, the escalation is on the order of $20 million or more. That's just for factual information. It is the last plan that we presented to the LCC committee and which was, in fact, rejected.
Senator Dale.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner, for the last couple of decades or more, when I've come into the Capitol on the south side, I've always been very surprised to find that the doors that I go through do not open out, but they open in, which is, I think, entirely inappropriate in case of a fire, masses of people trying to get through that kind of a door. In this plan that you presented to us, is that one of the safety issues you plan to fix?
Mr. Chair and Senator Dill, absolutely. We are out of compliance with almost every conceivable building, fire, and disability accessibility code. We don't have, for example, a shelter in place. We don't have enclosed stairwells should there be smoke, a smoke incident in the building, and many, many, many other issues. This will address the most basic of those needs.
Many members realize that the Senate did support both of those proposals. The House opposed both, and the governor didn't make a comment. So there seems to be a little problem with the House in having senators in this building. That seems to be a hang-up.
Before they leave, Mr. Chairman, one of the long goals has been to deal with the parking, but to go underground. I take it from what I heard today that going underground is no longer a choice or an option.
Mr. Chair and Senator Foley, I don't know that that's the case. I will be the first one to tell you that I'm extraordinarily sympathetic to the lack of public parking in and around the Capitol complex. We have said that here now for some time, and we would hope that, first of all, the planning money here that we have asked for, the House is quite insistent that we need a more comprehensive Capitol complex plan and that we would look at what are the parking needs in and around the Capitol. But a factor in that is the implications for light rail and what light rail will do to the commuting patterns of both visitors and employees in the Capitol. And so we need to be evaluating and looking at what will be the needs going forward from 2011 on with respect to parking in and around the Capitol, given the prospects of light rail, which will go just exactly to the north here of the Capitol building. It will snug right along the sidewalk at the Capitol building, and there will be, as planned currently, a public stop at Rice Street.
Okay. Our next project is a request in the amount of $3 million for capital asset preservation and replacement. It's an account that is a statewide fund managed by admin on behalf of all state agencies. We ask for a biennial request for CAPRA, and our current balance is under $400,000 right now. And it happens to come at a time when our aging infrastructure and weather are catching up to us. We've had greater demands in the last couple of years on CAPRA. Recent appropriation history was an amount of $3 million in 2005. which has been expended fully, and $4 million appropriation in 2006. Again, a little less than $400,000 left in that account. What this would represent, though, is simply a replenishment of that account. For state agencies, what this represents for them is it allows for quick response to emergencies, and when hazardous materials are discovered on a project, they typically turn to admin in this account to help them get through that and move on with their projects. So, in effect, it minimizes the impact on their agency budgets by having CAPRA available to them. It is available to all state agencies. And as I said, we've had tremendous pressure on CAPRA, especially in the last year. The photo that you see here happens to be of Whitewater State Park. About $500,000 was appropriated from this account to the DNR to deal with that septic system overload in southeast Minnesota flooding last fall. And we have spent a fair amount of CAPRA funds on the DOT building. The $700,000 that Commissioner Badgero mentioned partially was funded through CAPRA to get that building to retain its occupancy and be safe for visitors and occupants. So that is the CAPRA request for this year. And then finally, our last request is a pre-design request on behalf of the Department of Public Safety. This is in the amount of $500,000, again, to conduct a pre-design for a new state emergency operations center. The current state emergency operations center is located in downtown St. Paul in a leased facility, and it really is unsuitable for emergency management functions. It does not meet federal requirements for homeland security emergency management in a number of respects. Namely, an EOC should be away from a high-rise, from all high-rise and mid-rise structures, and at least 80 feet away from parking. The building that they're in today, the parking is underneath, so it's right there on site. It should be away from congested areas where traffic may impede response and recovery operations, and it should also be outside of known risk areas such as rail corridors, any transportation of hazardous materials, or floodplains. The current site meets none of those requirements, and on several occasions here, even recently, have experienced flooding because they are in the lower level of the building. Potential benefits of a pre-design. This, again, is a request to look at the scope, timing, and cost of a potential relocation of the State Emergency Operations Center. Benefits to that would include an increased facility ownership for long-term cost control and equity. It would provide the opportunity to improve the technological infrastructure supporting that operation. It would be an opportunity to implement some sustainable design strategies and reduce operating costs. And it could potentially, what we'd intend to look at is military affairs and how they conduct their emergency operations. Through the pre-design, we would look at any potential for co-locating the emergency operations functions of those departments. And that concludes our prepared comments on our five projects for 2008.
Senator Frederickson.
Chairman, Commissioner, where would you locate that emergency operating center? Would it be on the Capitol complex here, perhaps the property you referenced that the state might buy?
Mr. Chair and Senator Frederickson, most likely not. But, of course, that is the reason for the pre-design. Most likely it would be away from a downtown metropolitan area, which would be itself susceptible to some kind of emergency. I think we do have a representative of Homeland Security here who could maybe give you a little flavor. But really a pre-design would look at what are all the factors to comply with federal law that we would need with respect to this emergency operations center. In my judgment, I believe it would be likely away from downtown St. Paul or the Capitol complex.
Mr. Chairman, we had the presentation from Public Safety, and their thoughts are that they would be interested in locating it at the where the Twin City Arsenal is out at 96 and 10 and 35W out there.
Okay, one of the bunkers.
Any further questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
As you probably noticed, Marge looks a little different now. Jennifer Burks is my new LA, and you'll be seeing her quite a bit in the future.
you know, and there are a number of people that think that I've got the bill all ready to go. That isn't true. We're obviously playing around with it, trying to see what some of the possibilities are, and it's going to be extremely difficult. But all of you are perfectly welcome to stop in at my office at any time, either talk to Kathy or both of us, and have your suggestions. But I have warned people to be prepared to be disappointed, because I don't think very many people are going to get as much as they wish. When you have a $3.5 billion with a request and you're able to do 965, obviously, it doesn't figure out really. But you're all welcome to stop in. A number of you went to quite a few of the tours, so I think you know quite a bit about the different sites. But of course, one thing about visiting those sites, when you leave, you almost always wish that you could do it, or hope that you can do it. And in most cases, you can't. So. Okay, meeting adjourned.